Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. As a child in the foothills of the Himalayas, Priyanka Kumar was entranced by forest-like orchards of diverse and luscious fruit, especially apples. These biodiverse orchards seemed worlds away from the cardboard apples that lined the supermarket shelves in the United States. Yet on a small patch of woods near her home in Santa Fe, Kumar discovered a wild apple tree, and the seeds of an odyssey were planted. Could the taste of a feral apple offer a doorway to the wild? In her new book, The Light Between Apple Trees, Kumar takes us on a transformative journey to rediscover apples, unearthing a rich and complex history while illuminating how we can reimagine our relationship with nature. Priyanka Kumar is author previously of Conversations with Birds. The recipient of many awards. Her essays appear in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Review of Books, Orion, Sierra Magazine, and others. She's been featured on CBS News Radio, Yale Climate Connections, Oprah Daily. She holds an MFA from University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts and is an alumna of the Bread Loaf Writers Conference. And she wrote, directed, and produced a feature documentary, The Song of the Little Road, starring Martin Scorsese and Ravi Shankar, which premiered at Telluride and is in the permanent collection of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Priyanka Kumar, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom, for having me here.
Great to talk to you. So I want to have you talk to me about this childhood experience in the Himalayas with an apple orchard. But tell me how this current book project came together. I understand this was an orchard, a feral orchard, right? A wild orchard near where you live.
Yeah, it's one of the oldest orchards in the area that I live in. And I had heard about the orchard and I really wanted to visit it, but it was on BLM land. So I needed to find someone, and it was locked up. So I needed to find someone who could get me entry into the orchard. And that happened one October morning. And I went in there with a gentleman who had been, you know, taking care of the trees a little bit because previous orchardists apparently had butchered the trees the way they had pruned them. And so I finally went in with someone who knew what he was doing, and we spent a whole day in this orchard. And for me, the aha moment was when there's just one neighbor. It's a very underpopulated area. And this fellow showed up and he said to me, you know, this is New Mexico's Walden. And it just hit me that truer words were never spoken. And I was, it had been raining quite a bit, and I was, which is unusual for New Mexico. And I was standing by the pond and a lark flew by grazing my cheek. And there's a resident heron that lives there. And then we bushwhacked our way through all this vegetation to get to this line of glorious apple trees that were heavy with ripe fruit. And I felt thirsty and I didn't have any water. So I just, you know, reached up and picked an apple and started eating it. It was just this wonderful experience to think about how long this land had been here. And I looked up and there was a line of ancient hills that I happen to know are rich with petroglyphs. So being in this land, I felt like I was at home. This is where I wanted to be. And I wondered about why this place was so magical, why it was so evocative. And I wanted to explore that further. And that, I would say, was a primal inspiration for why I wrote this book. It was musical. It really brought me back to my childhood.
Let's talk a little bit about that. You were raised in the foothills of the Himalayas. I guess this experience maybe triggered a childhood memory. You were quite young. Tell me about that orchard and that experience.
Yeah, and I feel like that childhood memory had been knocking at the door of my consciousness for many, many years. And I knew I would go in there one day, but being in this orchard made me realize that that was a pivotal moment and I needed to unpack that and figure out why it had been such a powerful experience when I was a child of about four or five. growing up in the foothills of the Himalayas, living in the heart of the Apple region there. Why had it been such a powerful experience when my dad took me to a private apple orchard, and it was just acres and acres and acres. And it was just me and my dad and the orchardist. And all day long, we walked among these mature mother apple trees. And, you know, the grown-ups didn't pay any attention to me. I was just like a little child tagging along because I loved apples. Because apparently, anyone who ever saw me with an apple in my hand. So I was taken along for this visit. And we finally, I was quite tired with all this walking, and we finally got to this turret-like glass room where there was just one chair, and the orchardist offered it to my dad. He sat down, and I sat down on his lap, and he offered us this apple, a yellow apple, and my dad gave it to me, and I bit it, and it felt like it had like this taste of custard and honey. It was very, again, it was very elemental. I felt like the earth, Mother Earth herself, was giving me an apple-scented kiss. And even though I was such a little child at the time, I think a world opened up to me, a world of intimacy with nature herself. And, you know, back then I didn't have many toys to speak of, but I began to see nature as my playground. And so I started to have these, I would, you know, walking to school every morning, I would have conversations with the mountains, and I would notice how the snow was falling across their peaks. And if sometimes I felt like, oh, today they're frowning at me, you know, what did I do? And I started botanizing at a very early age. And the first thing I was doing is I started to eat the wildflowers to see how they tasted differently. And so, you know, I ended up having this incredible childhood, the first 10 years of my life, where I was roaming the northwestern foothills of the Himalayas and later the eastern foothills of the Himalayas. And more recently, scientists have come to the conclusion that these are among the top 20 most biodiverse areas on our planet. And as a child, I didn't know any of this, but I think I was moved by the diversity of wildflower and fruit and birds and mammals. I mean, far away somewhere, you know, beyond where I was roaming, there was probably a snow leopard gazing at me. And so I was hearing these animals more than seeing them. But I became aware of the richness of this way of being in nature. And I think that is probably the best gift that I got from my childhood. And I keep circling back to it again and again. And every time it seems to reveal more riches.
This does seem to be a thread through your life. And you're in the book, you're suggesting we all should do a bit more of this, right? Get out of our digital device. Let's talk about that a little bit later. But I wonder, have there been times when you've been living in a concrete jungle and missing this?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, after those 10 years spent in the foothills of the Himalayas, my family moved because my dad was a government official. And, you know, we moved to Delhi, which is a huge city. And then as a diplomat, he moved to Toronto, which is another big city. And then as a graduate student, I moved to Los Angeles, which is, you know, so there were, it was bam, 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 three big cities. And I really felt that I didn't feel as fulfilled and as at ease as I had been as a child. And I was wondering what was missing, because I think even as a teenager, I didn't have the words to articulate what was missing. And interestingly enough, it wasn't until I was a graduate student in Los Angeles at the University of Southern California, and, you know, I was maybe at most 21, And I started to hike and backpack in California, and it became a way of life. And I think that was when I discovered birds. And I felt like birds were these beautiful messengers that called out to me and brought me back to my days as a child in the foothills of the Himalayas. I mean, Joseph Campbell says that one of the hardest things that we have to do and we must do as a human being is circle back to our childhood days. So, we become the lion, but then we circle back to becoming a child, and that's when we become truly whole. So I think that in some sense, I have been following that advice and circling back, and it really seems to be a worthwhile, enriching journey. And I would highly recommend this for anyway, I mean, I think a lot of people living today have that in their childhood where, you came back home from school and you were just able to go out and play. You just played until dinner time or whatever it was. And somehow we've lost that simple beauty that really enriched our lives. And I keep wondering, how can we circle back to that? We've lost it. We have to acknowledge it. And then how can we find a way to circle back to it?
Before we get to that question, let me just read this briefly from you, from Priyanka Kumar, in The Light Between Apple Trees. You say, "Lost in the maze of our devices, we may collectively lose our facility to sense nature's rhythms." What's lost if we don't have this nature in our lives?
So I think one of the fundamental things that's lost is our sense of time has been deeply fragmented. So I think what I experienced in the foothills of the Himalayas, I would go as far as to call it deep time. The kind of time that geologists are familiar with. And I lived in that time where you're in the present and you're also in eternity at the same time. And what's happened now, and again, I'll say technology can be an excellent tool, but it's when we abuse technology, I think. What happens is that time becomes deeply fragmented. And so we lose that sense of just being, just settling into our present. And so when I was at this apple orchard, for example, I just felt like I could settle into this experience. And I wasn't thinking about, do I need to check something? Or, I was living my life. And I was there with this neighbor who had known the gentleman who'd owned the orchard and had now passed on. And we were exchanging old stories, and we found ourselves drifting into the kitchen of this historic house and seeing where the person Alonzo, who had owned the orchard, where he used to process his herbs. And we were wandering out to places where apparently a 6-foot-long rattlesnake had been found. And the whole day passed by, and it was such a beautiful day that I can still recall it vividly as I'm speaking to you, Tom. And so I think essentially what I was doing is I was living my life. And what happens with these devices that we are all glued to these days is that we can never sink into the present moment. We're always kind of, it's always something else or what's next. And I think in getting caught up in that, we lose that connection that we have to ourselves internally and to the planet that we live on. And so I think that nature is the best medicine, that nature is nature is an ally. She's our friend, but at the same time, she does require us to be fully present. And man, if you're not present, you know, you may step on a rattlesnake who will bite you. So I think it's a wonderful experience to just spend, you know, if that's all you can do is just spend on occasion a whole day in nature. I mean, leave your devices in the car for sure. Don't have them in your pocket. And just spend a whole day just sunk in nature. And I think that that experience not only uplifts everything about you, including your mental health, but it also helps to circle you back to what was vital and alive in your childhood and kind of reconnect with those days when we were so closely aligned with our inner selves. I mean, everything that we do in life, in a sense, you know, from a practical point of view is great. And, you know, we have these houses we live in and we all make a living, but we also lose something along the way. We lose that alignment that we had with our inner selves. And I think that spending long stretches of time in the natural world can realign us. And it's just so enriching. And I think that when we do that, we realize why it's important that we still have why it's important to have the natural world around us. Because not only have these devices fragmented our sense of time, but the ways in which we live today, all this aggressive development has fragmented the natural world so that we no longer have the natural world to sink into. So I think that there's two things happening at the same time. It's like a double whammy that's hit us. And I think it's important that we know this, we acknowledge this. And then the next step is how can we be part of the healing? That's what I'm really interested in.
Mm-hmm. We'll go to break shortly, but I want to give people hope. You know, if you're living in the middle of a big city or not accessible, you know, to nature. I mean, I'm lucky here in Logan, Utah. I can, you know, 10 minutes and I can be alone in nature, right? Drive up the canyon. But if you're not, you talk in the book about the micro wilderness areas. There's good news. Yes. You can find areas probably near you wherever you live.
Yeah, I think that's excellent news. And this is something I discovered while I was researching historic varieties of apple trees and also feral apple trees. I discovered microwilds that were much closer to where I lived than I could have ever imagined. So I would really encourage people to wander in their neighborhoods and beyond, start a practice of walking every morning or every evening, and just wander and see if there's any feral fruit trees growing in your area. I mean, they might not be edible particularly. They might just be fruit that's good enough for birds, but it's still fun to, they still blossom so beautifully in the springtime. And I think that all of us, even if we're living in cities, have access to what I called the microwild. These are little fragmented pockets of nature, but they're spaces nonetheless that you could sink into, that you could have a beautiful morning in, perhaps discovering some interesting wildflowers or a little patch of raspberries growing near some wet area, or perhaps even a feral apple tree. And then the next thing you see, a bird, perhaps you see a Western tanager or a yellow-breasted chat that's coming to the apple tree at the end of the summer. And so one little discovery leads to another little discovery. And pretty soon this becomes a special space, not only for you, but for the other people in the community. And then you want to figure out a way to keep this place. You don't want it to become the site for yet another subdevelopment or what have you. So yeah, that was one of the magical aspects of working on this book and looking for feral apple trees, that they're all around us. And it's not just apple trees. Sometimes I come upon a feral apricot tree that's been planted by birds. And I think that's why fruit trees, I almost look at fruit trees as symbols of nature's love for us, because consider what they give us. They give us shade, they give us the beauty of their blossoms, and then come fall, they give us their fruit. I mean, it's I'm very interested in the ways that nature sustains us, and I think fruit trees are almost like the perfect symbol for how nature can sustain us. If we give ourselves to nature, she really gives herself to us. So I would encourage everyone to just wander about your neighborhood and see if you might discover a feral fruit tree as well.
You're listening to Access Utah. We're talking with Priyanka Kumar. Her latest book out now is called The Light Between Apple Trees. Previously, she's author of Conversations with Birds and speaking to us, I believe, from Santa Fe, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Beautiful area of the world. We have much more to talk about. I'll alert you, Priyanka Kumar, following the break. Maybe you could read a passage from the book, just select something. So we'll take a brief break here. We'll be back with much more with Priyanka Kumar. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer, naturalist Priyanka Kumar. The latest book is called The Light Between Apple Trees. She takes us on a journey to rediscover apples, unearthing a rich and complex history, while illuminating how we can reimagine our relationship with nature. So Priyanka Kumar, do you have a brief passage you could read us from the book?
Yes. Thanks, Tom. I'm going to read us a brief passage from a chapter 8 called Pulling the Crank. And this was in October, my first visit to the Real Orchard, where I fell in love with the glorious apple trees there. But this passage is really just about the landscape and me taking in, just absorbing the feel of the land. Taking in a sweeping view of the land, I was struck by its splendid brooding air. The old house and an adjacent field seemed to be cut from the same ancient cloth. Who had lived here, and how did this land survive the ravages of the 20th century? Primeval basalt hills loomed over us, framing a wide field edged on its south side by mature fruit trees. This ribbon of hills stretches all the way to Socorro, a 2-hour drive south, and the hills are rich in petroglyphs from a time when native Karasen peoples lived here in pueblos until the early 1600s. Still older petroglyphs have been dated as being 8,000 years old. The land sings with history.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, tell me about some of the orchards that you did some extensive research, right?
Yeah,
Tell
I
me about
mean,
some of your favorite places.
one of the things that I was amazed by is how researching orchards kept taking me deeper and deeper into American history. I mean, I feel like America really had a love affair with apples for a very long time. We have a 400 plus a year old history with apple trees. And one of the figures that I became quite enchanted by was John Adams. And he, so, I've been tending to my compost pile for over 15 years. And it was wonderful to know that John Adams was thinking just as deeply about his compost pile. And he was experimenting with adding seaweed to the compost and then spreading it. And he was one of the only founding fathers who didn't own slaves. So he was working with a hired man and spreading that compost very lovingly along his meadows. He was growing his own apple trees, you see. It was a dream of his to grow apple trees with his own hands. And he dreamt that his grandchildren would one day harvest fruit from trees that he had grown with his own hands. And other than that, he also had this habit where he wouldn't dream of starting a day without a gill of cider. And this is why he and his wife, Abigail, were growing their apple trees and making their own cider. So just going back to some of these historic orchards, but also going back to the stories and realizing that, you know, these intellectual men and women who, you know, and he goes on to become such an important leader in our country, but he was also thinking about his compost pile and his apple trees and his cider. And he took the time to do that. And that wasn't just hard work that he was putting into his orchard, but I think it must have been in some sense regenerative. It was also flowing back to him, all of that time spent in nature. So I think that aspect, especially John Adams' his story, was very inspiring to me. And then of course I got very interested in some of the old varieties. Like there's one called a Newtown Pippin. It's one of the oldest varieties dating back to the 1750s. And, you know, Thomas Jefferson was growing it as well. And I recently harvested some of my own Newtown Pippins from my orchard. And so it was great fun to be able to tell my younger daughter that this variety goes all the way back to the 1750s. I feel like apples have a way of bringing history to life. And that was one aspect that I really enjoyed. And I, of course, I went to Monticello and as a fellow there at the Center for Historic Plants, I spent a month studying Jefferson's North and South orchards and the variety. I mean, he's a very complicated man, of course, and I address that in the book. But what was staggering is that he was growing about 170 varieties of fruit. And, you know, it's the biodiversity that we've lost today. We're compared to some of those old orchards where I was doing research, today what we're growing is a monoculture of apple varieties. And the problem with that is once you get hit with some kind of viral disease, you lose all those trees. And then you don't have the resilience that you would have if you were growing all these different varieties. There are something like 16,000 named varieties of apples in America, or there were. And today, perhaps about a fifth of those are accessible to us.
Hmm. So that's an example of loss of biodiversity, right? Some of those varieties probably lost forever, are they, or...
Well, you know, some of those varieties are lost forever. There was a variety that Jefferson especially praised called the Tolliver, and he called it, he said it's the closest you can come to silky champagne, and that's extinct. So that was a historic apple variety that's gone. We still have the Newtown Pippin with us. And that was a variety that, incidentally, not only was it grown a lot in Virginia in the 1700s, but it was a variety that Benjamin Franklin, you can always trust Benjamin Franklin to, you know, figure out how to really make something, even of an apple. So he decided that the Newtown Pippin is a great keeper. So in days before refrigeration, you could harvest it and it would keep for a few months, almost until March. And so he decided that we should export this to England. And boy, it became a big hit in England. And even Queen Victoria became a devotee of this apple. So you know, these are some of the rich stories connected to the old apple varieties, but most people don't know of these varieties anymore. Most people are just familiar with perhaps, you know, the four or five varieties that you might see in supermarket aisles. So one of the reasons I wrote this book is I felt like there was this richness here these stories needed to be told. And this was a way for us to come back to this beautiful love of apple trees and inspire us to perhaps plant a few in our own backyard or in a community garden, or if you can't do any of those things, but just, you know, visit an orchard or a farmer's market and just get to know some of those beautiful, like the Jonathan apples that are becoming ripe now. It's like a red ball-like apple. It's being called the essence of the American apple. And boy, I just love that. Why is it the essence of the American apple? Well, you have to find a Jonathan and taste it, and you'll find out.
How do we reverse this loss of biodiversity? Is it, I guess, one by one, each of us plants a tree? What, how do we do that?
I mean, thankfully, there's still a few old dedicated orchardists still around. So you can go to an independent nursery near you, not one of the big box store nurseries, but an independent locally owned nursery. I mean, I feel like just in the same way, a lot of people came around and started supporting independent bookstores. I think it's time to support our independent locally owned nurseries and get an apple variety that would be a good fit for the region where you're in, where it's resistant to some of the common diseases like fire blight, for example, and really talk to the orchardists. And there are these wonderful people and their repositories of knowledge and plant a couple of trees. I mean, it makes sense to plant at least a couple of trees so that there's some good pollinator action that happens. But yeah, plant a couple of trees. And when you do that, you're getting your hands into the soil again, which is so good for us. We're now, scientists are now finding out it reduces incidence of autoimmune diseases if we can, get some soil onto your skin again. And then there's this tree that you've planted with your own hands. And perhaps you could have a dream just like John Adams that one day, either your grandkids or just kids in the community will harvest these fruit. I mean, apples, I love apples because such a sturdy fruit. I feel like it's like the grandmother of all fruits. I mean, they have such an ancient history and their scientific story is so interesting. I think it's a wonderful thing to do, to plant a couple of different apple varieties. And you'll find it's a little infectious. You keep wanting to, fit in one more apple tree. and it's really wonderful. And when it's fall, you bring over bring over the community. And that's what Thoreau used to do. I found out not long back that he and his brother loved not only planting apple trees, but also melons. And when the melons were at their peak ripeness, they would bring the whole community over and throw a party, and they would just eat the melons. And people remembered that for a long time. And Thoreau's brother passed on early, and people just remembered how these two brothers would throw this melon party every summer. And it's an amazing community-making experience.
Tell me about your community making experiences. You say that nothing brings neighbors over like a chance to eat a unusual variety of apple.
Especially during the pandemic, I grew up in a culture where when I was a kid, I grew up in this culture where hospitality was a very important part of the, just living. You had people over and you shared the fruit. And it was just such a joyous experience. And so during the pandemic, that's probably the thing I missed the most, is you couldn't have people over. So I started doing these apple tastings on my porch, a portal, as they call it here. And I found that people would wander over, kids especially. That's how it got started. And boy, once kids find out that you have some interesting apple varieties, they spread the word. And so I was sending people away with little paper bags of, just apples that I had harvested near me in the microwilds or in historic orchards that I'd been able to get into. And I found that everyone from, a carpenter to a car dealer, no one ever refused an apple tasting. And everybody was highly opinionated about the apples that they were eating. And sometimes I would find these magical apples like the Hidden Rose, which is this beautiful variety from Oregon, and you cut it open and the flesh is pink inside. And kids who thought that they didn't like apples, their eyes would light up seeing the Hidden Rose. It's like it's a magical experience. This is an apple. And so I was able to keep this element of hospitality going through the pandemic, through these apple tastings. And I have now what I would call apple friendships, with people here in New Mexico, but also in Virginia, where I stayed for a month researching the apple varieties there. And I certainly came into contact with people from all walks of life and came into contact with people where, we might have kind of different political opinions, but at the same time, we could still, share a good laugh and a smile over the apple varieties that we loved and do little apple exchanges. So I felt like this is a very elemental thing that Americans share, our love for apples, and it's a rich history. It's really worth tapping into. And so that's really what I try to do in the book. And I had not thought at the beginning of this journey that apples could be something that bring people together, but that was my experience, especially in Virginia.
Let's head toward another break. By the way, if you want to find another brief passage in the book, we could do that at the beginning of the next segment. We're talking with Priyanka Kumar, author previously of Conversations with Birds. And the new book is The Light Between Apple Trees. That's out and available now. You can find Priyanka Kumar at her website, priyankakumar.com. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have Priyanka Kumar with us. She's author previously of Conversations with Birds, and the new book is The Light Between Apple Trees. The subtitle is Rediscovering the Wild Through a Beloved American Fruit. We're talking about that. We have another 10 minutes in the conversation here. So Priyanka Kumar, do you have another passage you could read us?
Sure. I'm going to read us a brief passage. And this is from a chapter titled The Generosity of Blossoms. And I was at another historic orchard in New Mexico called Las Golondrinas, the Ranch of the Swallows. And it's a ritual, it has been a ritual for me for at least the last 15 years to go there every October at harvest time. But while researching the book, I made it a point to go there at springtime as well, when all the apple and the pear trees were in bloom, and it was just gorgeous. So this is from the end of that chapter where I talk about why the blooms are important, and I go into all the bees that pollinate, different types of bees, native bees and honeybees that pollinate apple trees. So this is just kind of a poetic end of that chapter. Recollections may vanish or turn into half memories, but powerful remembrances sometimes return to embrace us. My apple love connects me to the past and influences my future. I now feel inspired to create apple rasa for others. Rasa is a Sanskrit word that means juice. At Las Golondrinas, I saw the same trees, only they are fuller and taller as those Lenora Curtin saw in 1932. In that year, my parents weren't born yet, but these trees were already vibrant and strong. Astonishingly, decked out like debutantes, they still sing their flowery songs now when my own children are in elementary school. Perhaps a Spanish rancher planted the trees 100 years back with the same fervent hope with which Michael and I have planted and care for our young apple trees. Considering the long history that we share with apple trees sustains my enthusiasm to go on growing them. It makes me wonder if our trees thrive, who will enjoy their blooms 100 years from now? Planting trees is an act of generosity. a way of communing with those who will come after us. The act of growing fruit trees asks that we change our relationship with time. No great thing is created suddenly, any more than a bunch of grapes or a fig. Epictetus wrote, "If you tell me that you desire a fig, I answer you that there must be time. Let it first blossom, then bear fruit, then ripen." Those who will one day enjoy the trees we tend to today may not know our names, but in some future autumn, they will harvest the ripe fruits of our handiwork, and in a future spring, animated by Las Golondrinas, the swallows, they will know us by the scent of opalescent blossoms.
That is Priyanka Kumar from her book, The Light Between Apple Trees. That's what we're talking about today. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful passage.
Thank you.
I just want to read this. I got a kick out of this. You say in the book, "My children have sharp opinions on how many hikes per week are appropriate." So it's you dragging the kids out. I'm sure they enjoy it, right? So my question is, that's. I think it's natural with kids, right? Tell me about seeing these places through your kids' eyes.
Yeah. So, for a long time there, we were hiking to look for birds and other creatures. Kids are closer to the ground than we are. So they really notice the insect population, also the snakes and what have you. And my younger daughter especially got interested in looking more closely at the wasps and the butterflies, and she would do a little catch and show us and then release them. But at the same time, whereas Michael and I seem to have an infinite appetite for the walks, it wasn't the case with the kids. And we got to a point where they were groaning at the breakfast table. "What? Going on another hike? How come we never go to malls like other people do?" So, and by some coincidence, it was right around the same time that I became interested in fruit trees. And it seemed to dovetail nicely, because I think that fruits, especially ripe fruits, are something that really draws kids in. They're interested. They have this innate desire and ability to climb trees and get to the fruit that, we couldn't get to with our arm. And so they got interested in this. And whether it was, finding little clusters of raspberries by stream sides, I felt that that would really pick them up and connect them. It's a very primal connection, a very juicy connection. And so I felt that this journey that we then went on to look for old historic fruit trees really reinvigorated our hikes together. And the kids became engaged once more, whereas I think they were starting to hit rock bottom with those birding hikes that we were doing. So it was, in a sense, fortuitous that I found this fruity path. And so I would really encourage people to try this, because I think it's just so amazing to have kids climb fruit trees and bring fruit down for you. By the same token, I sometimes come upon areas like there'll be like some botanic garden where they have big signs that say, "Please do not pick a fruit." And I wonder, what's this all about? I mean, we're in a crisis here right now, Tom, where kids are so disconnected from the natural world. And we need our kids to get interested in harvesting fruit. I mean, we should have, welcoming, embracing signs. So when I see those signs, I just kind of go, "Oh my gosh, you guys, you need to loosen up. We need to go back to the basics and have kids embrace these fruit trees and love them." and want to take care of, because they're really the caretakers of the fruit trees that we're planting today. So we always try to get them engaged in the act of planting the tree. And just last night, and it was getting very late at night when we were planting. This was not a fruit tree, but a blue spruce. And, you know, the kids went out with the flashlights and they wanted to put some mycorrhizal fungi that would touch the root and keep nourishing these trees. And it was a bit of an adventure for them to put that tree into the ground. And I think we definitely need to take down the signs that say, please do not harvest the fruit, because that's pretty counterproductive.
Just a couple of minutes left. I want to end where we began, talking about how we can put down our devices, get out into nature, and how these, you know, you might have a feral orchard that you can go to, or you might find one of these micro wilderness places. But you write, my practice is to let the material world fade and instead tune in to nature's throbbing connections. So how, your brief advice, how do we do that?
I mean, the key there is the word practice. And when I use that word practice, I'm talking about a ritual. I go out there with the kids. I mean, I'm out there by myself every day, but I make sure that I go out there with the family every Saturday and Sunday morning. That's what we do. It's a ritual. And so I would encourage people to have develop some kind of a ritual. If you can't quite do it at the intensity that I do, just have, you know, a couple of days every month that you set aside, perhaps just a morning to go look for birds or to go look for feral fruit trees in your neighborhood or to seek out a historic orchard. And once you start talking to people, especially in your local independent nursery, you'll find out where the historic orchards are in your neighborhood and make it a ritual. You know, visit them every year, like I visited Las Golondrinas every year at harvest time, a few times a year, but at least every year, and go and harvest some trees. And there's nothing more beautiful or more invigorating than eating fruits that you've just picked and eat them right there, right under the tree, and experience those beautiful, beautiful connections that are there. And think about who planted that tree, maybe, 50 years back or 100 years back. And that's a wonderful mystery to unravel as well. And thank them.
Well, good place to end the conversation. Much else we could have talked about Ursula the bear. You write that bears and apple trees are braided together. The history of apple trees goes back to Kazakhstan, apparently. You'll have to read the book to get those nuggets. We've been talking with Priyanka Kumar, author of The Light Between Apple Trees. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for listening to Access Utah.